Welcome to Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m., and where we consider the increasingly frightening assaults on democracy under the regime of Donald Trump. There have been numerous apocalyptic and jaw-dropping developments since our last broadcast in August, too many to list in this intro, but some of which we'll address during this hour with our regular panel, Ruthann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and myself, Richard Hill. Ruthann teaches English at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. She's also directed plays for the Westport Community Theater and hopefully may do so again someday. Scott Harris is the host of Counterpoint, a public affairs show that airs here every Monday. That is on WPKN at every Monday at 8 p.m. And he's also the executive producer of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, a nationally syndicated show that also airs here on WPKN a couple of times a week. I host the First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio Show, the Organic Farm Stand, and I'm on the roster of hosts for the public affairs program called Mic Check, which airs every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. on WPKN. And by the way, my shift comes up tomorrow, which is the second Sunday, so I'll be back here with an interesting program. Connecticut clean energy activist Paula Panzarella will talk about the ongoing battle for reliable and affordable energy in Connecticut. And also this week, we will be joined by local activist Valerie Horsley. She is the co-CEO of Action Together Connecticut, and she's an elected member of the Hamden Legislative Council. And she'll talk about what needs to be done to ensure voter protection and participation in the November 3rd election and many other issues that concern the progressive community. So why don't we kick it off, as usual, with some conversation about some of the other issues that we're obsessing about. And let's turn to Ruthann, a panelist who is joining us by phone today. Will you kindly break our fast with some trenchant analysis this morning?
I'm not sure how trenchant it's going to be or how analytical, but I tried to get very serious this week and put together some hard data, but I ultimately asked myself, which of the zillion topics should I choose? So I chose them all, and my little speech this morning is called How Much Can We Take Before Paralysis Sets In? Timothy Egan's op-ed in the New York Times this morning, for example, on the burning of the West, is eloquent and elegiac. The latest word from the scientists working on stemming the COVID pandemic counsels patience as vaccine development moves speedily ahead, although not fast enough for the man in the White House who wants an October surprise vaccine to nail another 4 years of his brand of cold chaos. Every day we see new headlines and predictions about how schools and restaurants are trying to function along the fluctuating COVID curve. Americans protesting persistent racism and militarized policing are attacked by armed vigilantes urged on by the White House. A genuinely enjoyable Democratic virtual convention is followed by a rabble-rousing spite fest of a commercial using our federal property as backdrop, prop, and billboard in front of a crowd evidently designed for the spread of the pandemic. Kanye West may run as a third-party candidate, he says. This morning we hear the latest about Green candidate Howie Hawkins' bid to get on the Wisconsin ballot, where Jill Stein's run 4 years ago may have tipped the state for Trump. Every day it seems we get updates about the fate of the mail-in ballot, state by state. The South, predictably red, suffered from terrible storms this hurricane season. Now the West, predictably blue, fights raging fires under orange skies. Trump boasts that he has a new and much worse nuclear weapon, and maybe peace agreements in Israel and Afghanistan, and of course Russian manipulation of the election process. And every day I, like every American with an email account, get 100 or 2 requests to be the one who saves the U.S. from electoral disaster. If I give $5, $10, whatever I responsibly can on my old person budget, the ask always ends with make it monthly, and then within hours I get another email for the same candidate, plus, of course, every candidate running on the blue ticket in every state and town. Worse are the subject lines. Take this poll. Real quick question. Fairfield Post Office closes. Why does Ruthann love Trump? Or why does Ruthann hate Biden? I think I can occasionally indulge in some resentment. Why can't college students resist partying on weekends? Crowd fests that jeopardize their health and the health of everyone they will come into contact with for days. Why can't friends and families give up the barbecues and beach parties and bar nights that traditionally strengthen our human ties, but now strengthen the chain of transmission? Climate change has made the West susceptible to more and more sweeping fires, but why do people still go out into their woods and yards with firecrackers? No, whatever the man in the White House says, we should not be raking the forests. But we should have been working more diligently with the other nations of the world on slowing climate change. Why couldn't Trump share the truth about COVID with the nation as soon as he knew it, which it turns out was January, instead of worrying that we might panic, as if he isn't sowing panic about the armed invasion of the sacred suburbs by savages or stormtroopers at the polls? Why did Barr and company suppress intelligence reports about Russian interference with the elections, and why was that suppression permitted? Why can't Congress or someone stop Barr from pressuring honest judges and investigators to quit or step aside or down? And in the name of all that's holy, why can't the Senate pass the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act to protect our quadrennial attempt at democracy, instead of leaving it constantly to be fought for piecemeal in a series of politically tainted courts? Worst of all, though, I'm afraid I am exhausted already, and there are still 7 weeks to go. Luckily, I'm a very stubborn person, but what of the perfectly reasonable people who, sometime during these 7 weeks, just give up? And that is my main question and my concern, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Richard or Scott.
Thanks, Ruth Ann. I really appreciate that enumeration of the things that we're coping with here, because as I mentioned in the intro, there are too many for me to list them there. And so it's great that you actually presented to some degree the full scope of what we deal with on a daily basis.
This is just the surface of it. That sick feeling you have every time you turn the news on.
But it's just bizarre. This script would have been rejected by every major movie producer or publishing house. It is just too surreal and too absurd.
Absolutely.
And it is our reality. But Scott, I know you always have something that's gnawing at you, so why don't you share that with us today?
Well, after Ruth's enumeration of the chaos, I'm going to have to go out in the hall and meditate for a few minutes. It's too much. I'd like to talk about a very eye-opening incident involving Norwalk Police Department and State Senator Majority Leader Bob Duff. And I'm just going to quote from Bob Duff's open letter about this incident. And I got a chance to speak with Bob Duff on my show this past Monday evening. But this is from an article by Ken Dixon, which kind of just encapsulates what occurred. State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff says he was recently intimidated by as many as 30 Newark police officers who, after a meeting in police headquarters, verbally harassed him, then approached his car in a threatening manner as part of their opposition to a controversial law enforcement accountability bill that passed days later in the General Assembly. Duff's visit to the police headquarters included what he called aggressive expletives from police officers, one of whom, the veteran lawmaker claims, spat toward him before he was escorted from the building by a lieutenant. And Duff says that 2 weeks afterward, a motorist drove by his home shouting more expletives that were heard by his family and kids. Other Democrats who voted for the police accountability bill in the state legislature said they, too, have been subject to degrees of harassment by police. And that includes State Senator Christine Cohn of Guilford and State Senator Marilyn Moore of Bridgeport. And there may be more. But just to kind of give you the rundown of what occurred that day, I think Ken Dixon talked about the harassment, the surrounding of the car, the spitting. This occurred at a police department where supervisory police officers were present. But the most important thing that I got out of the entire summary of the incident from Senator Bob Duff was this, and I'll just quote from his open letter. He said, "The hour and 15 minutes I was at the Norwalk Police Department headquarters that day is something I thought I would never experience in my hometown. You see, as I was driving home, and up to this day, I've asked myself repeatedly, if that happened to someone like me, a privileged, middle-aged white man, an elected official, the Senate Majority Leader. What happens every day when no one is looking and cameras aren't turned on to others in our community who don't have the background or platform that I occupy? You should ask yourself the same question every day. That's from Bob Duff after police basically tried to intimidate and bully him. I think spitting is a physical assault. At any rate, just in closing, I would say that the police demonstrated here, and I'm not including all police, but certainly a large number of them, and the other officers who might have objected to the behavior did nothing to stop it. And that's the exact same behavior that's triggered a national movement to rein in police abuse of power. And I give Bob Duff a lot of credit for coming forward and going public with this incident. He could have just chalked it up to emotions running high by these police and kind of dismissed it and walked away and not said anything about it. But I think he really shed a lot of light on the kind of gang mentality that exists all too often in police departments and police unions, and is the very reason that I'm happy that, you know, despite the tragic deaths of all these people, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all those folks, it's good that the nation has exploded in protest, because this is a problem long overdue to be addressed in a very forceful and aggressive way, as demonstrated by this one incident, as kind of small as it is. It really, I think, does, again, shed light on the systemic problem we have with police abuse of power.
Well said. And I think that it's interesting and noteworthy that the limited immunity that police are granted, the bill that addressed that problem in the state of Connecticut was to some degree watered down. There was a compromise made, and it was certainly not as strict a rule that was a rule change that was made, so that the in spite of the fact that it was a very minor and mild version of that thing, that the police just went completely crazy. I Christine Cohen, Senator Cohen, is my representative, as well as Robin Comey, who was a state House representative. They reported a lot of really ugly pushback and screaming at them from families and police directly. And it's just unbelievable that this is the reaction that people are confronting when change is made at a level that begins to shake the system at its roots. Very interesting story, Scott. I wanted to, for my little slice today, I just wanted to pose a question and see if I could get you folks to engage a little bit in it. So the question I want to put out there is, are Biden and Harris and the Democratic National Committee, along with Tom Perez, pursuing the old playbook from 2016, not to mention 2000 and 2004, looking for that thin slice of support from white, so-called independent middle class and suburban voters? And if so, if that's their strategy, is this a winning strategy? And just one data point, the largest political bloc in this country are those who are eligible to vote but who choose not to. There are nearly 100 million of these potential voters that both major parties don't really pursue with any vigor. And Obama managed to generate a larger than usual turnout by Black, Latinx, and youth voters who often sit out elections because his team figured out how to reach and inspire these demographics. But will these voters stand in line for 6 hours to vote for Biden and Harris in this election? And what do the candidates and the DNC need to do to make this happen? So there are some questions. Scott, maybe if you could go first, I know you're going to have to jump off.
Right. Well, just in terms of Biden's selection of Kamala Harris as his vice presidential running mate, you know, I think a lot of people observed that and said, well, Biden understands that he needs a big turnout in the Black community, because 2016 was the year when it was the first decline of Black voter participation in a presidential election in 20 years, which, of course, contributed to Trump's election. Now, whether Biden's presence on the ticket is going to, you know, increase turnout this time around, is an open question. And, of course, the Latino vote, the youth vote. What's, I think, universally understood pretty much by pollsters is that there's not a lot of enthusiasm for Biden. You know, I think I've heard a lot of interviews, a lot of anecdotes, but I think there's some polling data to back that up. And the thing that's driving, Biden's majority in the recent polls is, I think, the acknowledgement by people in the country generally that Trump is a danger to democracy, and his erratic behavior, I think, with the coronavirus that has led to so many deaths. It's quite amazing that as many people continue to support him as they do. But in terms of enthusiasm, I heard an interesting round of interviews on an NPR show, and the interviewer was talking with some black voters around the country, and I think all three or four of the folks they interviewed said they weren't that enthusiastic about Biden. One woman says, yes, I'm not enthusiastic, but I'm going to vote. I'm going to make sure I vote because there's too much at stake. But the other few on this interview call were, they were kind of cynical. They basically said, you know, I've heard that every election for my whole adult life was the most important election in U.S. history. And Bush was elected. And, you know, they went through a litany of previous Republican presidents and say, well, the world didn't end. Well, it ended for some people, and a lot of people suffered. But there's a lot of cynicism out there about politics and Democratic politicians, including Biden, out there, which I think is a real danger. And there's a lot of concern. I'll just close off by saying in the Latino community, there's some polling data that suggests that the Republicans are doing a better outreach right now than the Democrats. And you're seeing a gap in terms of the numbers of Latino voters who came out to support Hillary Clinton in 2016 and those who say they're going to support Biden this year. And I think there's alarm bells ringing among the Democrats as to what's their ground game? What are they going to do to try to get folks out who need to go? You know, and it's kind of amazing when you think Trump began his campaign in 2015 by talking about Mexican rapists and murderers, right? I mean, that was the whole anti-immigrant thing is his main bag. But yet, you know, Trump is doing 36% in the polls among Latino voters. It's kind of frightening stuff going out there under the radar that I don't think any of us have a handle on.
I think that we tend to splinter along a lot of different lines. When you look at the Latinx vote, for example, it's not monolithic, just as the black vote isn't monolithic. You can go through and look at income groups, for example. A number of, especially the Latino people in Florida, tend to be entrepreneurial, and they do lean Republican in spite of Trump's contempt for Puerto Rico and how many of the Latinos in Florida are come from Puerto Rico. In the West, we're looking more at a Mexican origin, and they tend to be less concerned with, as best I can tell, less concerned with laws that benefit business people, and more concerned with social well-being laws. There's also a kind of ideological divide that we've just been reading about in our house, that the Florida group, if you can say group, is more inclined to be conservative, and the Western group is more inclined to be liberal. So if you try to go after a monolithic concept, you are missing a lot of people, and you may be turning off a lot of people. On top of those splinters, we've got the same splinters everybody who lives in this country is dealing with, and the way that we underestimated the blue voters in the last election because we get very purist about candidates if we've been given a lot to look at, and then we only wind up with two. We say, no, that one is not quite liberal enough for me, or that one is not quite conservative enough for me, and so I'm going to whatever, or I'm going to sit it out. And finally, I want to say that in 2016, we saw we saw the risks of turning out voters who are eligible to vote but haven't voted before. I think that was the wave that brought Trump in. He managed to energize a lot of people who hadn't really been active at the polls before.
Well, that was certainly the case with Obama. The Obama coalition was a mobilization of some of those 100 million eligible voters who don't vote, who tend to sit out elections. And it always galls me that, people like the DNC and Tom Perez, who was, just the most feckless, I think, of spokespersons for that group. They come out with the same cheerleading thing every time. Oh, don't worry, we got this taken care of. Joe Biden is inspiring this and inspiring that. I fear, as Scott said, and as you said also, Ruthann, Joe Biden is inspiring very little. He's not an inspiring guy. He's a guy who is, as I hear people say all the time, he's so nice. He's a guy with compassion. He's, Uncle Joe. This is not the kind of fuel that is going to light a fire under young voters, under working class black voters and Latinx voters, working class people who have to possibly give up work to go to the polls, will now have to travel further, will have to overcome voter ID restrictions, all kinds of shenanigans from the Republicans. That's what I said before when I said they're reverting to the old playbook, which is to look for that little sliver of voters in the center that strayed over the line and voted for Trump, defined right after the election as white working class voters. Turns out, really, they were really middle class white voters. But that's the same game plan. And it's just, I think, absolutely playing with disaster. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Valerie Horsley, who is the co-CEO of Action Together Connecticut. She's going to talk to us about voter protection and participation in Connecticut, along with a lot of other issues that Action Connecticut, which is one of the indivisible groups that sprang up right after 2016, are pursuing in our state. But any other comments from you, Ruthann, on this the strategy that the Democrats are...
It's riskier than leaving them entirely alone, and sometimes that is my fear with the Democratic strategy. You know what Obama did best? And he did it in that convention speech that made me say, this man is going to be president someday. He managed to create pictures in people's minds, and they were pictures of the way that people live and the way that people want to live, because he was very specific in his speeches. Politicians tend to be really general. Trump creates very specific pictures in his audience's mind, too. They are very scary, negative, stereotyped pictures, but he evokes them when he talks. But Biden, I like Uncle Joe. I have loved him at moments. I loved him when he said big effing deal loud enough to be overheard when the Obamacare was being signed, for example. You think, he's got a lot going for him that we don't often see. And I hope that he does. But generally when he speaks, it's the generalized terms that we're accustomed to hearing from politicians on the left. They're not energizing because I think partly because they're not specific. We don't have a stump speaker on the left. We don't have somebody who can get up and really, like Obama speaking at Lewis's memorial service, and adds those cadences of his closing speech on being able to vote, rolled out one after another in the church stood, and by the end everyone was standing. But you don't get that when Biden speaks. You don't get it when Harris speaks. The rolling standing ovation, which is something that a skilled orator and somebody who can be specific and make imagery can get. And Trump can get it because he rouses something else that we don't like to think about. So I'm worried.
Yep. I hear that.
Well, you know, Richard, we were talking about how difficult it is it must be difficult. We were talking the other day about how difficult it must be for the media to decide how much coverage to give the violence, especially the manufactured violence, such as we saw at Portland and in Wisconsin. How much of that to cover? Because you know that you're playing into a certain narrative that is political rather than objective. But if you don't cover it at all, you may be making people feel that you're suppressing something or you're not a very good news station because there are crises going on and you're not letting anybody know what they are. And you had some interesting observations about that.
Off air, we were talking about the fact that the candidates now, with the assault from the right in terms of trying to recharacterize this entire massive civil rights uprising that's been happening for the past couple of months, recharacterize it as basically riots, looting, burning, and violence by a bunch of left-wing anti-fascist thugs, that the response from Biden has been very defensive. And understandably, right? He's trying to say, no, I don't support the looting. I don't support the burning. I don't support the riots. I do support the demonstrations. So he's trying to find make that fine distinction between those things. But in so doing, what is being lost in this conversation? I mean, I hear this every day on the media pundits. I heard it last night on the, Mark Shields and David Brooks' little segment when they have it on the NewsHour. PBS NewsHour, Mark Shields, like, Biden has got to make it clear he doesn't stand for riots, he doesn't stand for looting and burning. I've heard Biden do that three or four times, you know. And I think to some degree, pushing him further to the center, turning him a little bit more vanilla, a little bit less focused on the systemic problems that he needs to talk about and needs to act on if he had power, to really make serious and significant change in the country, and also to inspire people to support him.
Absolutely. And those are things that he has traditionally been very strong on, that he believes in social justice, and he believes in a society whose mechanisms promote social justice. But partly as a result of that slogan that it's really impossible to restate, but it always has to be explained before most people can get behind it, the defund the police. And then you say, well, that's not exactly, they don't mean to eliminate all police. What they mean is, and before you get finished talking about what's meant by it or what may be meant by it, you've lost the point. But in order to counter that controversy, he's wound up practically sounding as if he's the law and order candidate himself, and that's unfortunate. Of course, maybe there are policemen spitting at him as they drive past this house. That was heinous, what Scott was talking about.
All right. We are now joined by Valerie Horsley. She is co-CEO of Action Together Connecticut, and she's also an elected member of the Legislative Council of the City of Hamden in Connecticut. Valerie Horsley, are you with us? And if so, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, sure. I'm glad you could have me this morning.
It's great to have you. I remember back in the early days of the Resistance Roundtable, you were one of our first guests. And the reason we were excited to have you back then was because you had just been one of the founders and movers and shakers behind what I think at that time was Action Together New Haven. Was that the name of the group?
Connecticut and New Haven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it soon became not just a municipal or citywide thing, but a statewide movement based on the, the indivisible model that was developed right after the 2016 election, in which tens of millions of people were trying to figure out what to do with their shock and alarm at the development of the election of Donald Trump. So tell us a little bit about what the organization was and how it's evolved in the ensuing years leading to this moment.
Yeah. So once, you know, we were all in shock after what happened in the 2016 election and really trying to figure out what we should do to support Connecticut as well as federal legislation and around issues that we thought were important. We realized pretty quickly that we have really two really great senators and really great House members in Congress. And so we really focused at that time on the state, because in 2016, for the first time in 100 years, the state Senate was split 18-18 Democrat-Republican. And they really couldn't get much done that year legislatively. So we really went to work to try to understand how to support campaigns around the state to sort of win back a Democratic majority in 2018. And there was a sweeping blue wave that went across locally in 2017, but also at the State House and State Senate in 2018. And so now we're still doing that work. We're supporting legislation that fights for people and making sure that equality rings in Connecticut, but also supporting candidates. Today I'm knocking in Wallingford for two great candidates that are running in this area.
So what are some of the other things? So you're focusing, again, is your main focus will be in-state on Connecticut politics and Connecticut candidates and issues, or are you also trying to mobilize voter registration for the national election as well?
Yeah, so we are also doing work to try to make sure people know how to vote, since we are in a pandemic and it's an unusual times. And so we've been doing some advocacy trying to make sure people understand how to vote absentee in case they don't want to go to the polls given the potential risk of getting infected. And we've also been, we will start in a couple of weeks doing phone banking for Biden-Harris ticket as well as state candidates in Connecticut.
Can I ask a question here? Valerie, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for making time to come on this morning. What worries you most about this election? You know, there's a lot of polls talking about Biden up, of course, in Connecticut, but around the country in the battleground states, a lot closer. There's a lot of concern about under-the-radar Trump voters, voters who won't admit that they're voting for Trump, and that, you know, you might have a surprise like we did in 2016, where some of these battleground states narrowly go to Trump. As you look at the bigger picture of this election, what is of most concern to you right now?
I would say it's similar to what happened in 2016, where the majority of people in the nation vote for Biden-Harris, but because of the Electoral College and the way that's organized, these few states decide the presidency. I still think that's a concern. Definitely trying to also reach out to other states to make sure that we can use our advocacy here in Connecticut throughout the nation, but I think we have to make sure people get out to vote. I was at a backyard barbecue, socially distanced, a couple of days ago, and I met a young man who was not registered to vote in Connecticut because he said, "Democrats, you know, win all the time here, so why do I need to vote?" And I pulled out my app, registered him to vote right then, and I said, "You need to vote. There's some important candidates in your area that are running, and we need every vote for Biden-Harris, even if you feel like it doesn't matter." So I think there's a lot of apathy that comes with voting and dealing with politics. And so I think, you know, we need to try to get everyone out to vote as much as possible.
There's interesting information that's coming in as the census collection process continues. I actually have a friend who lives in a poor section of northern Florida, Alachua County, near Gainesville, and he's doing data collection. And his stories that he tells me from his experience of doing that are very discouraging to me, because it sounds like, I mean, it's the census, it's not the vote, but people are really, really alienated from the whole process of being of what we consider to be a representative democracy and what's involved in actually affecting that kind of representation. Census is critical to that. So he's an older white guy, and a lot of his constituents in terms of who he has to canvass are a very, very poor people of color who are, they see him coming up the steps and they don't even want to answer the door because they think there's trouble coming. And then he goes to other areas, which are wealthy white sort of ranching sections of that part of Florida. And they're all Trump voters, and they don't want to talk to him because they think the government is the deep state and against all their interests. So, I mean, this is not voter registration. It's not the actual, doesn't necessarily comport one-to-one with whether they're going to vote or not. But it's very discouraging to me that, for example, on Long Island, there's about a 50% compliance with or reporting of data to census workers from people of color. I just wonder, in Connecticut, what kind of outreach is happening and what kind of reading are you getting from the large communities of color in our state where people tend to be alienated because, as you said, they're cynical. They don't see the point or the benefit in participating in the electoral process.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are busy. They have other things on their minds, even beyond our urban centers, which are primarily communities of color. I think really getting out and talking to voters is the way to drive up participation in elections. And so that's what, you know, we try to do through Action Together Connecticut. And that's what candidates that are good candidates and want to hear what voters have to say are going to do in those areas. And so I think really trying to reach out and make sure that we knock on doors and tell voters our message is really the best way to do that. But at the same time, we also need to engage in legislation that, you know, really fixes the social problems that we have in those areas so that the disenchantment and disenfranchisement is, you know, kind of cured. We need to focus on education. We need to focus on jobs creations in our urban centers. And really until we do that, it's hard it's very clear why those voters feel that way.
How do you do that in this strange environment we live in now? You said door knocking with these communities that are literally sequestered, or strong red lines are drawn between the white residents of Hamden and black communities. How do you cross those lines? How do you break down the barriers? And how are you coping in terms of the COVID situation, in terms of making it happen?
Yeah, I mean, we're fortunate in Connecticut that the infection rate for COVID is quite low. And, you know, I've been knocking doors for a couple of months now for different candidates around the state. And, you know, I wear a mask and I approach the door and then step back to give plenty of more than 6 feet between me and the door. And people have generally been receptive to that for talking. People are also really, you know, a little bit lonely because we've been sort of in a restricted situation for many months now. So I've found that voters do want to talk and hear about what they can do to support the different issues that we agree on.
I'd just like to ask a quick question. As you door knock or talk to people on the phone for this election campaign, what are some of the biggest Connecticut and national issues that you hear about from voters, you know, that they're top concern? I'm sure the coronavirus is up there somewhere, but I'd like to hear some of the anecdotes maybe of folks you've spoken with.
Yeah. I think people are concerned about taxes in some of the areas of our state because our taxes are pretty high. People are concerned about healthcare issues. I had a woman who told me about how she hasn't been able to afford healthcare for her ailing elderly parent and is feeling very stressed about that, especially given the pandemic. And so I think voters are interested in the same issues that we haven't solved in the last 4 years.
Can you update us on the protocols for voting in Connecticut? My understanding that Connecticut is one of the states that does not have early voting. In other words, there are no polling places you can go to early and cast your vote. But I'm not up to speed on all this stuff. So perhaps you could just run down some of the things that you are focusing on as you try to educate voters for this November 3rd election.
Yeah, sure. So there's two ways to vote. You can vote in person, just like normal, at your normal polling location.
On Election Day.
On Election Day, on November 3rd. Or you can vote by absentee ballot. That is a two-step process. The first step is applying for the ballot. And you can do that by either downloading the application from the Secretary of State's website or by asking for it from your town clerk. It is also being sent to every voter in Connecticut by their own town clerk. So once you receive that ballot or download it, the application, you fill that out and then you mail it back or place it in one of the drop boxes that have been placed in every town. Your town clerk will then get that application and send you a ballot that you can then fill out and return it either again by mail or into the drop boxes in town. And so that's a way that you can vote easily, early, and avoid the polls, if that's what you wish to do.
It sounds like basically you can literally just wait for the Secretary of State to send you the application because that's going to go to every registered voter. Is that not the case?
That's correct. But I think the problem is that because we haven't established the system in Connecticut before, the amount of work that the town clerks are going to have to do for this election in counting absentee ballots and sending them out, et cetera, is going to be way more than they are used to. And so the earlier you can do it, the better, to make sure that they just have ample time to, you know, get the ballot to you, et cetera. There were some problems with the primary process, and some voters did not receive their ballot in time for the election. And so the Secretary of State's office decided that the town clerks would send out the ballots this election, so that we can make sure that it's locally controlled instead of a statewide process.
But the application for the ballot, is that also being sent by the town clerks, or does that come from the state?
That's being sent by the state.
Okay. Yeah, I called my town clerk this week and I said, you know, what do I do? And she said, well, you should be receiving an application for an absentee ballot from the state sometime in the next two weeks. And so I said, okay, can I trust that? Can I believe that? We'll see. Go ahead.
Sorry. They should be coming in the next week or two. The ballots will not be sent out till October 2nd. So there's still a couple of weeks for folks to apply.
And Valerie, I'll just mention here what I talked about in a recent program last month, that when I tried to submit the application for an absentee ballot for the primary, it got very screwed up. And I would just advise our listeners, and you could probably add to this, Valerie, that you have to be very careful in filling out the application and the ballot, because it's not quite as obvious as you'd think. And if you address it the wrong way or put something improper in the window of the envelope, it's not going to get to where it's supposed to be. So pay extra careful attention. And it's not just me. I've heard a lot of examples of this, in this recent primary election, that people's absentee ballots and applications got screwed up. Can you shed any light on what people should be careful about or what they should pay extra attention to?
Yeah, so there are two things, really, that is my understanding, that were problematic. One was what you described, where the windows of and how you folded the paper, you could just send it back to yourself, or you could send it to the town clerk. You can kind of get around that if you use the Dropbox, because the envelope will just be opened and be used by the and be opened by the town clerk and counted. The other issue was that folks did not check that COVID was the reason for the absentee. So if you do not give a reason for why you are requesting the absentee, then the ballot will not be sent to you. So you really have to make sure that you check on the application for the reason and check COVID. So that was the major issue that happened in Hamden, according to our town clerk.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Is there a, does every town in Connecticut have a Dropbox?
Yes, and some have multiple.
Okay, excellent. And I think you can also take your ballot directly to the town clerk if you're.
Yeah, that's right.
If your town hall
if
is
your
open.
Town is open, right. You are able to directly deliver it to the town clerk. Mm-hmm.
So, for those people who are tired of waiting for the state to send them the application for the ballot, you said you could download it online. Can you give us
yes.
the link to that?
It's at the Secretary of State's website. I'm not exactly sure what the link is, but if you just go to her website, Denise Merrill's website, you can download the application. I did it a couple of weeks ago and sent mine in.
I see. So you print it, and then you just mail it in
yep.
as normal.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay. Well, Valerie, we're coming down to the very end of the show. Just want to give you a last moment here to just maybe do a little rabble-rousing and try to get some more support for your organization and how people can volunteer and help and get involved in this
right,
process.
Right, right, right. So thank you so much for having me on. I, you know, it's really important that we recognize that every vote counts. Some elections are super close, and we want to make sure especially that this election is a landslide victory for Biden and Harris. You know, reach out to your family and friends, ask them if they know how they're voting, ask them, you know, who they're voting for and why. These are conversations that we've, as a society, have been told we shouldn't give, but really this is important enough that we need to be talking to everyone we know and making sure they're voting and talking about issues. You know, you can volunteer with Action Together Connecticut. We will be doing phone banking weekly from your home every Thursday starting in 2 weeks. And, you know, we want to help get out the vote in Connecticut for Biden Harris, but also for your local candidates that will make a big difference in your life. So you can find us on Facebook at Action Together Connecticut. And yeah, we hope to see you at a phone bank via Zoom soon.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Valerie Horsley, for joining us today on the Resistance Roundtable. Valerie is a co-CEO of Action Together Connecticut. She's also an elected member of the Hamden Legislative Council. And it's great to have you with us again. We're going to be coming back to you for updates and on your activities.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Valerie.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Be well. You've been listening to WPKN's monthly program. Comes to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. Resistance Roundtable with Scott Harris, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, and myself, Richard Hill. Any last comments from Ruth Ann? Haven't heard from you for a moment.
No, this has been very interesting. I just hope that next month we'll be able to focus in on something we've already laid out rather than having a whole new set of chaos to deal with.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
No, I just think if there's anything we can rely on is that there's going to be more chaos and more ugly things going on in this country over the next few months.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned to WPKN for more programming. Barricada is up next.